If you will, turn to the book of Habakkuk, chapter 2. It's a pleasure to be with you this morning. I've changed the order of the topics just a bit. Instead of talking about Gideon, I'll talk about Noah this lesson, and then the final lesson this afternoon we'll be talking about Abraham. And so we're going to move from verse 5 of Hebrews 11 right through verse 10 and look at each of those verses. In this lesson, we're looking at verse 7, the faith of Noah, but I want to begin in the book of Habakkuk. Let me tell you how Habakkuk is different from the other prophets. While the other prophets were concerned with delivering a message to Israel or Judah or sometimes even a Gentile nation, Habakkuk is a discussion that the prophet has with God. And while the prophets, the rest of them, were dealing with imperatives, with commands that God had given to the nations, Habakkuk is asking a question of God. And in chapter 1, there are two questions that he asks. He starts out there in verse 2 talking about the circumstances in his society. His world was falling apart. Criminality was rampant. People were literally getting away with murder. The law was not being observed. And Habakkuk asked God the question, Lord, how can you allow this situation to continue? Why haven't you put a stop to this? Why haven't you stepped in and done something? And in verse 5, the Lord answers that question. He says, oh, I am doing something, Habakkuk. I'm going to send the Chaldeans into the land, and they are going to clean out Judah. And I imagine when Habakkuk got that answer, he's thinking, I'm sorry I asked. Because that leads to a second question there in verse 12 and 13, where Habakkuk says, Lord, as bad as we are, we're not as bad as the Chaldeans. How is it that you can use the more wicked nation to punish the more righteous nation? You know, there are times when we tell God, you simply can't be thinking of doing what you're going to do, right? Lord, you can't do this. And usually when we tell the Lord he can't do something, he says, well, you just watch me. And so after Habakkuk asked this second question, he has enough sense to shut up. He doesn't know what the answer is going to be, but he knows there's going to be an answer. And he's going to go to his watchtower and wait for God to give him an answer. And the answer comes in verses 3 and 4 of chapter 2. God says, Habakkuk, you're right about the Chaldean. He's proud, he's arrogant, his soul is lifted up within him. I'll deal with him in due course. But what I want you to know, and here's my answer to your question, what I want you to know is that the just shall live by faith. Again, you don't need everything. You don't need all the answers, Habakkuk. You just need to know something, and that is that the just shall live by faith. You trust me. That was the answer that God gave Habakkuk. Have you ever wondered what was uppermost in the mind of Jesus in the training of the 12? What was he trying to instill in those men and develop in the 3-some years that he spent with them? Well, I think possibly the answer to that question is he was trying to put faith inside them to where they would implicitly trust him, no matter how absurd it appeared to them something was that he said, no matter how the odds seemed to be stacked against the fulfillment of his word, he wanted them to trust him. Did you know that the only thing he ever criticized them for was little faith? Oh, ye of little faith, turn to Mark chapter 4. Let me illustrate what I'm talking about. The first 34 verses of Mark 4 are a teaching segment where Christ is teaching the disciples. Several times he says, he that hath ears to hear, let him hear. Pay attention to what I'm saying. Listen up. This means you. Starting with verse 35 of chapter 4 to the end of chapter 5 of Mark, we have a miracle segment. And what Christ does in verse 35 is what any teacher does. Christ, being the master teacher, after he had finished the instruction, gives a test to see if the students have have gotten the point. And so in verse 35, Christ says, let's go to the other side. They were up there on the north shore somewhere of the Sea of Galilee. Christ says, let's sail to the other side of the lake. And so they get into a boat and they set out across the lake. And about the middle of the lake somewhere, a storm comes up. Now, I've never been to the Sea of Galilee, but I understand the surface of the sea is 700 feet below sea level, something like that. I mean, it's below sea level. There are mountains around it. And what often happens is that in the afternoon, the evening, the warm rising lake air collides with the cooler descending mountain air. And when those air masses meet, there can be violent storms break out. And maybe that's what happened this day. A terrible storm breaks out. It's so terrible that some of the men in that boat who were professional fishermen, made their living on that lake, they conclude, we're not getting out of this alive. And they go to the back of the boat where Christ has fallen asleep. You talk about the peace that passes understanding. Anytime a crisis comes to my life, the first thing I get is insomnia. I can't sleep. But Christ is there in this boat, he's asleep, and the disciples awake him, and they say, Master, carest thou not that we perish? And Christ awakes, and he stands up, and he does two things. First of all, he rebukes the storm. He says, peace be still, and immediately, that lake turned to glass. When storms blow themselves out, there's often, for some time afterward, a residual motion of the waves. Immediately, the storm was stilled. And after rebuking the storm, Christ rebuked the disciples. He says, how is it that you of all people had no faith? You see, Christ said, let's go to the other side. He didn't say, let's go to the middle of the lake and drown. And they got an F on that test, and it didn't stand for faith. So faith is very important, that we trust the Lord. And in Hebrews chapter 11, we have a chapter, as I said earlier, that proceeds from that quotation of Habakkuk 2:4, there in chapter 10, verse 38. Now the just shall live by faith. And the Hebrew writer introduces us using the by faith formula. By faith Abel. By faith Enoch, by faith Abraham, by faith Moses, right on through the chapter of people who made faith incarnate, who made that principle incarnate in their life, whom we can look at and see this is what God meant when he said, live by faith. And I want us to look at verse 7. And let me read verse 7 again. By faith, Noah, being warned of God of things not seen as yet, moved with fear, the American Standard says with godly fear, prepared an ark to the saving of his house, by the which he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness which is by faith. It seems to me that there are two questions that are asked and answered in verse 7. The first question is, of what does Bible faith consist? The second question is, what does Bible faith produce? The first question deals with the characteristics of Bible faith. The second question deals with the consequences of Bible faith. And I would like to use those two questions as the two points of our outline for the lesson this morning. Let's begin by talking about what are the characteristics? What are the components of Bible faith? And the writer of Hebrews 11 says, in the case of Noah, there are three. The first of which is that Bible faith has an intellectual component. By faith, Noah being warned of God. Now, I don't know how God warned him. I don't know if God appeared to him in a dream or some other means, but somehow or other, God appealed to Noah's ability to understand. God gave him a warning. And Noah understood. and Noah believed. You know, there are people who try to make out that Christianity is the non-thinking man's sugar stick. And there are some places, and college campuses seem to be these places, where if you want to commit intellectual suicide, you let it out that you're a believer. And nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, the devil's really done a number in this regard in making us think that there's something not quite right with your thinking if you're a believer in Christ. Because the fact of the matter is, it is the unbelievers who believe the impossible. They want to portray us as having taken a leap into the dark. They're the ones who have done that. If anybody ought to be embarrassed and ashamed to admit to what they are, it's the atheist. They don't like to talk about what they believe. You know, simply to call somebody an unbeliever, that doesn't mean they don't have any beliefs. Goodness, unbelievers have more beliefs than I'll ever have, and they believe things that absolutely can't be so. Let me tell you what unbelievers believe. They believe either that something came from nothing, or they believe that something that is not living has always existed. Now, there are no other options for the atheist. Either there was a point where there was absolute nothing, no matter, no space, no time, no energy, nothing, but out of that nothing, something came. And listen, folks, something doesn't come from nothing. If there was ever a moment when there was nothing like that, there wouldn't be anything now. And so most of them aren't that silly to owe up to that. And so they say, well, something has always existed. And that something is matter. Dead, lifeless matter. They laugh at us. Oh, you think God created everything? Well, who created God? Ha ha. Well, they think matter created everything, so who created matter? And then they believe that this matter, which was lifeless and senseless and dead, somehow or other something happened, and it doesn't involve any natural process or force they've ever seen. They've got their own set of miracles. Something happened. At one moment there is no life, and then abracadabra, next moment there's life, and that life has evolved into all of the forms of life we see about us in the universe. If you're going to build a 747, man, you've got to have an intelligent maker behind it. But a bird that a 747 can't even approximate in complexity just happened. If you want a camera, you've got to have Eastman Kodak or somebody, Polaroid, who can do some thinking and put it together. But the human eye, oh, that just happened. I tell you, the atheist, the unbeliever, is the one who has committed intellectual suicide. God gave us a brain, and God gave us a book. And the book that God wrote is on the same frequency as the brain He created. I mean, if your ball game is on FM and all you got's an AM radio, you're not going to listen to the ball game. God did not give us an FM brain and an AM book. His revelation is on a level we can understand, and the highest glory of man is to take the brain God gave us and apply it to the book and come away with understanding. And every one of us have that capability. I mean, I've had a couple of debates with atheists. Back in the 80s, I debated the president of the American Atheist Association for Central Illinois, the Madeline O'Hare group at the University of Illinois. And then a year or so after that, I debated professor of thermodynamics at Iowa State University. And they like to make Christians feel like they're idiots. And they like to use words and terms and phrases, and if you don't understand what they're saying, then there's just something wrong with you. Listen, so long as you've got a brain, You can take your brain and you can access the same information they use, the same data they use, and they draw the bottom line and says, this adds up to no God. You can take your brain and look at the same data and draw your own conclusion. I'll tell you something else about atheists. They always have a story. They're not atheists because intellectually they have been driven to believe there is no God because of the information. I have never met an atheist like that. They're an atheist for some other reason. They've gotten mad at God somewhere along the line. Something's happened. Life's not turned out the way they expected. They've gotten mad, and their response is to say, well, then there is no God. That's why they are atheists. And first thing I ask an atheist when I'm talking with them, okay, what's your story? Let's hear your story. And more often than not, they tell me their story. It's not an intellectual reason they're an atheist. It is a moral reason. And that's what Paul says in Ephesians 4, 17 to 19. It's a moral reason. Bible faith has an intellectual component. Secondly, Bible faith has an emotional component. Noah, being warned of God, moved with fear. I think it was yesterday I was talking about emotions. Emotions put us in motion. Emotions are God-given. Sometimes we are so afraid of expressing any kind of emotion in our assemblies that if somebody says praise God or thank God out loud, we all turn and look like, what is this about? You know? And there are groups who have taken emotions to seed. Various charismatic groups. I mean, their religion more characterizes the religion of the pagans, who would work themselves up into an emotional frenzy. And to the pagans, the evidence that the God had taken control of their life was seen in the fact that they had lost control. They called it the divine madness. They'd roll around on the ground, they'd jump and scream, they would talk in they'd make sounds nobody could comprehend, and to them that was proof that the God had taken control of them. And there are religious groups today who believe much the same. But God expects us to respond emotionally to Him. We're to love Him with our mind and with our heart. Fear is the divine emotion that's given us. The kind of fear Noah had was the good sense to be scared. Samuel Johnson, the great English lexicographer, was a believer, an apologist for Christ, and one time he was at a gathering and he had a lot of worldly secular friends and they were talking about death, and Johnson expressed his own fear of dying and how he sort of dreaded that, and one of his secular friends was making fun of him. Why is it you're afraid of dying, Johnson? And Johnson said, because I don't want to go to hell, sir, was his response. I don't want to be damned and go to hell. Johnson had the good sense to be scared. Some folks don't have that. Noah moved with fear. He wasn't running from God because of his fear. He was running to God. And thirdly, there is a volitional component to Bible faith. He prepared an ark. He was warned by God. He moved with fear. He prepared an ark. He did something. He acted. He obeyed. Let me give you a verse that helps you understand what faith is. Psalm 37, verse 3, which says, trust in the Lord and do good. David doesn't just say trust. Faith demands a worthy object. He says, trust in the Lord. Listen, if you go out to the airport and you're wanting to fly to Denver and you walk out on the runway and you see a biplane with half the wing missing, full of holes, held together with baling wire, and there's a guy with goggles standing out front, and you walk up and say, can you fly me from the Springs to Denver? And he says, yeah. Where's Denver? Oh, it's north of here. Oh, yeah, I can fly. Get in. And you're starting to get a little suspicious, and you say, have you ever been up in this thing? Oh, no, but don't worry. I've read a book about it. You know, if you get on that plane, that's not faith. That's foolishness. Because that which you put your faith is worthless. Faith demands a worthy object, and faith demands a workable outcome. Trust in the Lord and do good. Do good. Noah prepared an ark. He did what God told him to do. Faith is not believing the unbelievable, but faith is seeing the unseeable. Hebrews 11 verse 1. You know, we use the expression that seeing is believing. With faith, believing is seeing. And because by faith, Noah could see what was coming, he built the ark. So faith has an intellectual, an emotional, and a volitional component. And then what are the consequences of faith? When a person has Bible faith, well, the writer says there were three. Noah's faith had an effect on his family, on his society, and on himself. He prepared an ark to the saving of his house. I was talking earlier about Enoch and Methuselah and how the one place you'll never deceive anybody about your faith is in your own family. I mean, our family knows us for what we really are. And for it to be said of a father that he, by his faith, was able to save his family, I can't think of anything more wonderful that can be said than that. I mean, what our great society, I have grown up during the great society, has done is that it has destroyed the family. And that's why South Chicago, I live just south of South Chicago, that's why it's the murder capital of the world. Because the family has been destroyed. It's been destroyed by our secularism, by our unbelief. Professing ourselves to be wise in social engineering, we have become fools, and our families have destroyed each other as a result. Let me ask you this question. I want you to think about the person in your life who wielded the greatest influence on your life, who did more to shape your life than anyone else. Now think about that person. Get them in mind. Let me ask you this. Is anybody here right now thinking of a movie star? Anyone here thinking of a pro athlete? Anyone here thinking of a rock musician? Anyone here thinking of a politician? Now, aren't those the groups that we're told by the media are the movers and shakers in this world, the ones who wield the greatest influence? Now, I'll tell you who you're probably thinking of. You're probably thinking of your mom or dad. When the writer of Hebrews 11 wants us to understand Moses, he begins by talking about two individuals who were dirt poor, brick-making slaves. Look at verse 23 of this chapter. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hid 3 months of his parents because they saw he was a proper child and they were not afraid of the king's commandment. Amram and Jochebed, not even named here in this verse. But if you want to understand Moses at 40, you've got to understand what happened to Moses at his birth. Amram and Jochebed have this child. The king's commandment is drown him. But they saw that he was a beautiful child. 3 times, Scripture comments about Moses' looks as a baby. And because of that, they defied the king's commandment. Now, does that mean if Moses had been a homely baby, they would have thrown him in the Nile? No, I don't think that's what it means. I think what that means is what's true of every parent, or ought to be true of every parent, grandparent. You know, our kid is the greatest thing that has ever come along. I go places and people start pulling out pictures of kids. And I say, you know, those are the the best looking kids I've ever seen, right after my three. I'm willing to give them fourth place and thereafter, but my kids occupy the top three places. These parents were committed to that child. And because they were committed, they were not afraid. There was a valor. Based on their vision, they saw he was a beautiful child, a gift from God. And that gave them a valor to where they defied the king. If you want to see what the impact of a parent's faith can have on a child, look at verse 27, same chapter, four verses later. By faith he, Moses, forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king. Now look back at verse 23. They were not afraid of the king's commandment. Like parent, like child. You want to raise a child willing to stand up against the depravity of society. They need to see a father and mother willing to stand up against the depravity of society. Bible faith will have an impact on our family. And it has an impact on our society. He prepared an ark to the saving of his house, but in so doing, he condemned the world. That's what it says, verse 7. By the which he condemned the world. Well, what does that mean? Well, I'll tell you what's meant in my experience. Have you ever been involved in a Bible study and you're teaching someone the plan of salvation and you get to baptism? He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. Repent and be baptized for the forgiveness of sins. And you go over those passages, and they've been right with you. They've been right with you till you get to that point. All of a sudden, a funny look comes across their face, and they say something like this. Now, wait a minute. You're saying that to be saved, you have to be baptized? Well, my folks weren't baptized. My grandparents were baptized. Are you saying they're in hell because they weren't baptized? Well, I'm not in the judging business. I leave that to God, but I will show people what God says. You know, there are people who can see what God says in Mark 16, 16, or Acts 2, 38, or Acts 22, 16. And they can draw conclusions. And even though you've not said a word about their folks or grandparents, they understand that what you're saying is a judgment, a condemnation. And they'll have to come to grips with that. I don't know if Noah stood on street corners preaching, if you don't get on the ark, you're going to hell. I don't know that he did that. Maybe he did. But by preaching that there is an ark of safety that you need to get on, implicitly, he was making a statement about those who didn't get on. And there's no way around it. I mean, there's just no way around that conclusion. If we're right in what we believe about Christ and he being the rock that we need to build our lives on, if we're right about Acts 2:38, that says something about those who don't believe Acts 2:38. That's a consequence of Bible faith. And then there was a third effect. Noah's faith affected his family, it affected his society, and it affected himself. He became heir of the righteousness which is by faith. The just shall live by faith. Listen to me. It may be that your family doesn't follow your lead in faith. They've got a mind of their own that they have to make up. They've got to make their own decision. They may decide wrongly. And maybe you don't convert any of your neighbors. You might not save your family. You might not save your neighbors. But by faith, you'll be saved. You'll be an heir of the righteousness which is by faith. A number of years ago, I had some dear friends. The husband was an elder in the church. They had a bunch of boys, I think maybe five boys. The oldest became a gospel preacher, and they couldn't think of anything better. I mean, that was their dream come true, to have a son who was a gospel preacher. But in time, this son became unfaithful to his wife, took up with a woman around the corner, divorced his wife, married this other woman. Their youngest son had gone away to college. One day he came home to tell his parents that he was a homosexual. And I can remember them telling me this story one Sunday afternoon after services, and they were just weeping and crying as they talked about these two boys. And then the wife spoke up and she said, you know, not long ago we got our boys together. And we told them that we love you. And we're here for you. We'll do what we can to be of help to you, but we're not going to let you keep us from going to heaven. We can be an heir of the righteousness which is by faith, even if nobody else wants to go with us. We can get on the ark. By faith, Noah was saved. You know, talking about Moses, God set Moses down to Pharaoh to say, let my people go. And Pharaoh said, who is this God that I should listen to him? Moses said, oh, you don't know who God is? Well, I'll enroll you in a correspondence course. 10 lessons. At the end of the 10th lesson, Pharaoh knew who God was. Well, hopefully, we don't need those kinds of lessons that Pharaoh got for us to know who God is. And if there's anyone here this morning who's willing to put their trust in God, who wants to be saved, who wants to be on that ark of safety that takes them to heaven, we invite you to make the response that Christ calls for now and to come while together we stand and while we sing.